Hello, and welcome back to the Hyper Theory Podcast. This week, we're really excited to have on Dr. Peter Hjørsted Hughes, or Peter Stjotset H, it's easier to pronounce. Peter is an incredible researcher on the cutting edge between philosophy, psychology, and this new field of psychedelic research. He draws from his training as a philosopher of mind and metaphysics, specialized in the thought of Whitehead, Nietzsche, and Spinoza, but in more modern fields such as panpsychism and recently altered states of consciousness and psychedelics. Peter is one of the driving forces of psychedelic research really worldwide, but specifically at the University of Exeter, where he runs the Psychedelic Research Colloquium, which is going to be offering, I might be mistaken in this, but the country's first postgraduate course in psychedelics. His course has actually made the news recently as a module on the world's first degree in magic. Peter's latest paper, titled On the Need for Metaphysics in Psychedelic Therapy and Research, which is out now and is a real call to arms to incorporate metaphysics in this renaissance of psychedelic therapy and research. There's a link in our description to give it a read. Peter is the author of a number of books, Numenautics, Modes of Sentience, and the editor and contributor to Bloomsbury's Philosophy and Psychedelics. He is also reportedly the inspiration behind the Marvel superhero Carnac, which, and I've researched that, is actually true, which is cool. But yeah, it was really great to have Peter on. Also, Peter was my first year logic tutor way back when in my university days. And we actually ran a few talks together. So it was just great to see him again and a really amazing conversation. Not just talking about his research in psychedelics and metaphysics, but also spanning the virtuality of post-pandemic life, alienation, human connection, loss, love. I think even Nick Cave gets a mention at one point, and the meaning of life. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it.
It seems that the most effective experiences are what I call metaphysical experiences. You know, they are like almost monistic or atheistic. But of course, psychiatrists, therapists, they don't know anything about metaphysics. And they're just applying what they've learned in psychology generally for therapy, you know, like used to be in analysis, to these new experiences. So it's my contention that as an additional and optional element of the final integrative phase of psychedelic therapy, there should be recourse to metaphysics, you know, like sort of metaphysics integration.
This is episode 2 of Hyper Theory.
It just gave me like the Data Protection Act warning, like just to let you know you're being recorded.
University's got really strict with all of that stuff, you know. When we have our colloquia nowadays, we have to tell people, like, if you're going to ask a question, be aware that you're being recorded. You know, yeah. You have to actually say that, like, verbally.
And yet, somehow, Amazon's Alexa is always recording by default unless you turn that function off.
Really? Well, that's why I'm never going to get something.
You optimize your experience.
I suppose it always has to be listening out in case you say, right, Alexa, you know, to get it started. So, record it as well. Okay, that's worrying.
They say to optimize, like if it hears you talking about desk lamps, then it notes that down and requests that you be shown desk lamps. And it does happen that you'll talk about something and suddenly you see it on your phone. If I'm mistaken, I will redact this in the podcast, but my recollection is that there is a feature within Amazon settings and it's an opt-out rather than opt-in, and it's not very well labeled.
Yeah,
basically, we are recording you unless you want us to stop. Which is, I don't know if you've seen, the documentary, The Social Dilemma?
I haven't.
It's sort of all the people that created social media and current big tech talking about how terrible it is.
The marketing generally, I don't have Alexa, but marketing generally is horrific. You know, I just refer. Yeah. The thing is, I use social media for marketing my own books, you know, so it's kind of, you know, essential exploitation.
Yeah.
I don't realize how bad it can get.
A necessary evil, perhaps.
It seems that way.
But yeah, in this documentary, The Social Dilemma, it's all the people that engineered sort of Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram and have since left those companies.
The Social Dilemma, you say?
Yes, yeah. And they're basically saying, we engineered this, so I can tell you how insidious it is. It's basically sort of psychological manipulation. We've designed it to hook you in constantly, so you'll add revenue, basically. And specifically, like, targeting like children and teenagers and teenage brains. And yeah, he's like, it's dark, man. And anyway, there's a philosopher you might have heard of, Jaron. I think his name is Jaron Lanier.
I just don't think I've heard of him.
Philosopher of social media, perhaps. Anyway, he's in that. I think it's him or perhaps someone else.
Do you remember that PhD student? It was contemporary, just before me. She studied alienation stemming from social media usage, sort of.
That might have been before my time, because I was a little first year when you were a PhD student, so perhaps that might have been.
She was just before me as well, she studied, devoted 4 years to studying this. And
what was her name?
Luana, but I can't remember the surname.
We can pull it up after and I can edit it in.
as
a shout out. But yeah, this philosopher, I think it's Jaron Lanier, just said this thing that just really cut with me, especially being Gen Z and what my experiences are and some personal experiences I can think of. Like, said that there's an entire generation that's grown up with a majority, at least, of our communication with each other in its heart. In every conversation, in every back and forth that's being had, is a center of manipulation that the two parties are unaware of. So it's created a generation of people where there's constantly some unknown, unseeable, insidious, manipulative force. And the impact of that.
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people now socialize more online than they do in life, you know, in reality. And thus, yeah, and they are sort of being watched, as you say. I mean, especially with like Facebook Messenger, you know, like everything's traced, they're explicit about it. But it's a bit like almost going back to sort of medieval times where you think that, you know, God hears everything that you say, you know. And so you have to sort of, you know, be very careful with anything you will not only say, but you think, you know.
So,
and then there was a sort of a period of secularization where people didn't believe that. But now it's sort of returning to this dark notion that, yeah, you are being watched constantly, you know.
Yeah.
And and also it's not very good for thought, you know, philosophy generally, because one has to be careful as to what one expresses, you know. And I think interesting thing is, I think that, well, in the last 20 years, I think people have become much more ideological and dogmatic than they were in the past. And then at the same time, of course, there's another ideology exploiting it all, which is sort of market force.
Yeah. I think there's two things I've observed with it. I think one would be there seems to be a feeling of maybe somewhat justifiable paranoia, maybe it's not the right word, but in my generation, of there is a valuable further understanding of things like psychological manipulation and narcissistic abuse, et cetera, et cetera. However, I think I do perceive a stronger sense of paranoia of, are you trying to fuck with me? Are you trying to play me? Like, is in my generation, which... Mm-hmm. When I heard him say that phrase, you know, at the heart of all of the majority of conversations young people growing up with is this field of manipulation. And then the second half of it, you say alienation, you know, and social media. The first time someone told me they loved me was over Facebook Messenger. It was a beautiful moment. It's like a light bulb memory for me. And it's still, at the end of the day, we're still two human beings interacting. But there's something pretty cold and wrong about that.
I think it also, this is progressing rapidly. I even think that, you know, meeting partners online is, you know, like I used to tease my brother for meeting his wife via some apps, you know. But of course, and he's only 4 years younger than me. But sort of, even now, I think that's, you sort of just arrange to meet in person. I find impersonal somehow. Another weird, interesting thing about that, of course, you get these apps to meet up, you know, just for one night or whatever, right? It's very common. And at the same time, you know, and then you've got all this pornography online, you know, and it's a free-for-all in that sense. But at the same time, in haptic relations, like, you know, real life, these kind of relations have become really restricted. So, like, you can't, you know, like, even touching somebody can be seen as a sort of some kind of offense.
Well, so, and not even to mention COVID, you know, a literal 2 meter barrier between.
Yeah, well, that probably just accelerated the whole thought of it. But touching people, for example, is seen as almost like, you know, a faux pas in some quarters, mm-hmm. at least. But at the same time, touching people via an app, if it's consented, is fine. You know, so you've got it's an interesting thing that social relations have been bifurcated into this sort of digital consent manner. And then some kind of, on the other side, it's like this Puritanism, you know, which would be quite appreciated by a lot of the kind of very conservative Christians of the past.
Which is also being propagated mostly on social media and in particular dark corners of the internet, so I'm told, as Twitter, which I do not engage with for my mental health.
Well, I do, again, just to sum up, you don't have, in my case, it helps, but otherwise, if I wasn't selling anything, I don't think I'd go on it. Yeah.
Nick Cave, the singer, has a fantastic thing about, you know, about touching people. And, you know, it's a different morality complex in a performance art-based setting. Not to say that consent isn't a factor. It's just a factor differently, shall we say. But he has this fantastic essay that he's written about, because he will go into the crowd and touch his fans and hug his fans, and they're all, and he talks about how liberating a almost carnivalistic act that is, and how needed it is in our world of alienation, you know, physical, mental, spiritual.
I think as I'm a kind of follower of Whitehead's philosophy, process relational philosophy, you know, our mental and physical identities are at one with the great, you know, nature. You know, Whitehead always complained that we shouldn't talk about the mind-body problem, we should talk about the mind-nature problem. And so touching things is a part of, you know, it sort of creates and is part of the process of who one is. You know, this is why the late romantic poets like to go into nature and sort of connect them, you know. That's why psychedelics induce nature connectedness, which induces mental health. So if culture becomes very non-haptic, it sort of emphasizes that individuality, doesn't it? Which then I would imagine has some seriously negative connotations. Even though you might think in the short term, this is a positive thing, you know, people have to respect your rights and your space and whatever, you know, the long general term, the opposite might ensue therefrom.
I think the world is complicated and complex, right?
And and of course, I mean, it only applies to some places, you know, even in the same country, in Britain, for example. I noticed that this sort of faux pas in the cities, London especially, is very different from how it is here in Cornwall, for example, you know?
Let alone somewhere further afield, such as Japan or Asia, and their entire relations to sexuality, touch,
Or even Lithuania. When I was in Lithuania about 10 years ago, I remember people just push you out of the way when they want to get past, you know? And first of all, you think, what the hell's your problem? What have I done? You know, do they hate foreigners? What? But then you realize they're each other, and they're not offended.
Or another boundaries, and it's like, well, whose boundaries? Who's here, and who am I pushing you away? Are you crossing my boundary, or am I enforcing my? You know, it's.
I think also there's a British thing actually with this individuality and space, because even in the language, and it, you know, it's like an interesting thing where we use the subjunctive conditional a lot in British, in English. Right. We say like, would you mind closing the window? So what it means is, you know, I'm not telling you to close the window, but if I did ask you to close the window, would you do it? Yes or no? Whereas in German, it's just close the window.
Close the window.
If you don't want to do it, you have the
free will to not do it. I'm not forcing you in any way to do it. I'm just saying. And there is almost a certain degree of, like, it's obviously politeness, reservedness, repression as well, but like, there's a degree to which you can have an opposite consequence, right? So like, in saying to someone, you want the window open, and in saying to them what you truly want, which is just open the window, you say to them, oh, would you mind if we opened the window? You know, is it, sure, respectable, reasonable. There's a value to that. But it can have the consequence of you're coming across potentially disingenuous and potentially slightly offensive. And I've had that experience as well. My British politeness has sort of gotten to a point where someone has just said, just fucking tell me the thing that you want. Be clear with me.
Yeah, there is something to say. I've experienced both worlds, though, or more than that, in Sweden, Germany, and in Britain, and Cornwall, you know, which is really separate from England. But there's something, I do like the British way in a way, because I think Germans, for example, can get very harsh very quickly with this directness. And of course, they're not as offended as we would be because they're used to it. But
right.
I do like the British sort of greasing of the wheel somehow with this.
There's something charming.
Another interesting thing there, it becomes like a craft, you know, to really work out what people mean and what they say. So
like a language game.
For example, like university, you know, which is pretty international, like Exeter, like most universities, I suppose. But someone said to me, oh yeah, that person said they're really up for that, you know, so that's that person on board. And I was like, well, how did they say it? Did they say they were interested or did they set a date?
Trying to read because you know that, yeah, as an Englishman, there's going to be layers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then it becomes almost a craft to work it out. So, you know, the first step is just learning English. After that, you have to learn sort of, you know, subtle connotations, what they mean, you know, and it's...
And they're put into biographical context that might have an influence, that even the context of what their day was like. Was the weather cold, you know? There's all these...
But you never work it fully out, yeah. And of course, you know, when you're speaking to people from other countries, you know, it's pretty hard to determine what people mean if you don't know their ways. That is quite an interesting thick craft, isn't it? You know, you can work out, it's not just body language, it's the connotations and contextualizations that, and if you become really good at it, of course, then you become a great diplomat. And I think it's generally a useful thing to learn this stuff, you know, over time. I wouldn't devote time to it, you know, like set time, but just notice these little nuances and sort of get on with life, I think.
Yeah.
Generally.
Sometimes a poet or an observer rather than a philosopher or a fixer or a maker. There's a reason why there are these roles and in society, you know. And it's interesting what you say. It makes me think of farming. And obviously, we're talking about culture and civilization, and that sort of emerged around agriculture. But I'm thinking very much in terms of when you talk about touch and thriftiness, perhaps, for want of a better word, and maybe one aspect of it, you know. The comparison between, say, somebody who grew up on a farm, a rural area, you know, Devon, perhaps, where we spent some time, and I believe you still are, or where I am right now, London, heart of East London, I mean, Kellingtown, you know, and the difference between farm living and someone who's grown up on a farm and the interaction with soil, I'm thinking in terms of the B12 that you absorb into your pores through touching soil. Yeah, things like shit. And, what, you know, when I was staying in the moors in Ashburton, there'd just be sheep shit around. And, like, who cares? Whereas in London, it's like the tiniest, I can't even touch. I have to have a washing up glove. And there is something very scientifically you lose out on. You are missing out on certain chemicals that you're absorbing, as well as a feeling of interconnectedness. So I think, yeah, there's something to be said ecologically, psychochemically, and societally about that kind of
relationship. As you imply, there are connections that we're not maybe aware of, which are very important for our well-being, whatever the well-being is, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a general problem of urbanization.
And there's also a vulnerability to touch. There's a vulnerability to being authentic. There's a vulnerability to speaking your mind. And there's a vulnerability to being assertive. You know, if you think from more of a social work perspective, people like Brené Brown talk about the power of vulnerability and our fear of it from shame, you know, and Luna Dolezal in the philosophy department at Exeter, a whole book on connection between shame and phenomenology from a feminist perspective. She's going to come on the podcast soon, actually. And if you're not familiar with her stuff.
A little bit, yeah. No, I haven't read the full book, but I've sort of dabbled.
But yeah, from that perspective, there's a vulnerability to an openness to interconnectedness, physical touch, and those socio-psycho, you know, touch.
I went to this Whitehead conference a couple of weeks ago, and there was a talk about shame, actually. It was the basic point is, you know, shame, you know, generally has got negative connotations, but it can actually get people moving. But the interesting question for me is, what is the basis of shame? I mean, what are the underlying ethical assumptions that will make you feel shame? And this is why, for me, as a sort of young teenager, really 18, you know, you come reading Nietzsche, you're suddenly like, oh God, all this stuff, I felt shameful, guilt and remorse, you know, I really needn't, you know, unless I fall into a certain ideology.
But perhaps there are better ways of self-correcting, and I believe there are better ways of self-correcting and morality than shame. I mean, shame, similar, I think, to pain, nociception in biology, philosophy of biology, purely the perception of some danger or something wrong and the avoidance of it in accordance. And pain has evolved as the mechanism of nociception, but ants, for instance, have nociceptors that don't have a pain response, and they are able to very well and definitely navigate away from danger without it. So I think shame is like a mimetic form of pain, and it's something we can correct upon and do better, because, yeah, we should. There are behaviors that are harmful and need correcting and need calling out internally and externally. But Brené Brown has a fabulous quote, something like, when you try to fix a problem through shame, it's kind of just like throwing fire on fire, because 90% of problems are caused by shame in the first place. So you're just sort of throwing more shame on the shame, and it's just building and building and building. That there are better ways of dealing with fire, for instance, water.
Yeah. It sounds like a return to some kind of like Spanish Inquisition, really. I think, you know, ideally you do away with shame completely. Think of the world and yourself in different ways.
I believe ideally you could do away with pain as well. And that was the previous podcast with Andreas Gomes-Emerson and David Pearce.
I was at Oxford yesterday. Was it yesterday already?
A couple of days ago, I think it was.
No, it was Monday. Yeah, sorry. Returned yesterday. But it was me, Philip Goff, and his panpsychist, and this guy called David Leon, who's Buddhist. You know, we were talking in the pub afterwards, and sort of, you know, the ultimate purpose of it all was to alleviate pain, to get rid of pain, to alleviate suffering. You know, this was the goal. And then, you know, the means to that was X, Y, Z. But of course, two things I'd say. Number one, the interesting thing you just said about ants there, they don't have, what did you say, they don't have certain pain receptors?
Nociceptor. I've only seen the word written down, but I believe that's the pronunciation. So they have nociceptors, but they have no pain neural architecture.
Well, maybe it's, I mean, still theoretically possible that pain can be realized in a different way in ants, right? It's like, do you know the whole argument about multiple realization and hunger? Well, just very basically, Hilary Putnam, you know, American philosopher, he said, there was this view in the mid-20th century called psychoneural identity theory, which was that mental states like pain or shame or hunger was identical to certain human brain activity. But of course, that would mean that an octopus, for example, or any creature, wouldn't be able to be hungry because it doesn't have a human brain, right? And so therefore, on the assumption that octopuses can feel hunger, it was then argued that, well, okay, like different mental states like hunger can be realized in multiple ways. So it can be realized in a human brain, but also an octopus brain, and also, you know, possibly an ant brain, right? So I'm just thinking about the pain, although they don't have receptors that are determined in us to be a condition for pain. Maybe they have something else that accounts for it, you know?
Yeah, maybe we're failing to empathize with these ants. We're like, God, these ants have it all figured out.
Maybe we're thinking about it too much of an anthropocentric manner, you know? It's like, you know, well, if they don't have these human receptors, then they can't have these responses. I mean, the same thing applies.
They have some plants, different spectrum of emotional feeling, of experience that's entirely outside of the pain pleasure.
It's very hard to, you know, determine that, of course, because, you know, what is it like to be an ant? You know, the classic problem about the mice.
Yeah.
But I still think, you know, the possibilities are open that ants and all insects feel pain. I think we shouldn't rule that out scientifically.
There's a guy called Brian Tomasik, who's very big in the like effective altruism community, and he had a fantastic essay, like a very difficult to argue with essay, writing about the ethical rights of video game CPU characters, sort of went as far as to say we should consider that they exhibit emotional responses and they have enough of a coding and programming and enough of their own existence and responsivity for us to philosophically empathize that they experience suffering, and we should avoid like shooting like people in Grand Theft Auto.
That's like a half video game gone then if you're not allowed to shoot people, right? I mean, that's
the sort of thing. Yeah, one free miracle, I'll explain the rest.
And that's like, you know, on the assumption that we can recreate rather than simulate sentience, right? Which is Johnson's thing. I don't think a computer avatar can, you know, has got his own perspective. Can't be sure, but...
But how could we know? I guess we can make our best guess.
Yeah, but, you know, like if you're going to know by behavioural responses alone, you're kind of assuming a logical behaviourism, and that, I don't think, went through a lot of criticism in the 20th century and sort of is now like has got very few proponents, you know.
I think David has something he calls valence realism, you know, so valence being the axis that's replaced pain pleasure as a slightly better conceptual architecture of speaking about desirable or undesirable experience. And his thing is sort of valence realism, that we can so as far to say that there is a reality to which, like, it's real for that back. So
I'll have to look at it.
It's not real in some grand philosophical sense. We should treat it as real from an ethical, almost from an ethical perspective, rather than from an epistemological perspective, you know, or on the side of caution, I suppose. But in perspective, Brian Thomasy, so he quite about ants, he quite publicly has posted his dating profile sort of online or Facebook, sharing it around. The thing he's leading with is, and said, the biggest issue that I've had with finding a compatible partner is effectively what we're talking about with ants. He's saying that he becomes so bothered by the treatment of insects around him all of the time, and that sensitivity in a romantic relationship has been the biggest block and biggest hurdle for him, and his pain at seeing others' carelessness, perhaps, or cruelty around insects is the biggest issue he has. And it's funny, we were talking about dating apps originally. So yeah,
It's very interesting, but then it ultimately comes back to these deep metaphysical questions, doesn't it? You know, like the extent of sentience. That's, I think, where we sort of, well, I gave a talk on panpsychism at Exeter that you organized or were there for, right? And
I organized,
you organized it, didn't you? Yeah. And so it comes back to that, you know, where does sentience stop on levels? And does that apply to insects, plants, AI? This is becoming an interesting problem now, because even if AI isn't conscious, it seems that a lot of people will begin to believe that it is, and that will have its own repercussions, regardless of its truth. But also, it's an ethical question. Let's say you're a panpsychist and you believe, and you're an, I don't know what the word is if you believe AI is sentient, but let's say you believe both. Still, the question is, well, how do you treat other beings? It's still not determined just because they have sentience, and even more so if they had pain. Even then, it's like, it's not clear.
Well, I mean, from a complete other perspective, somebody once told me, and I won't name who it is, but somebody who is a very established artist once told me that the reason they eat meat is because it is cruel. Even if we agree that, philosophically speaking, animals or others have experiences, then what my moral architecture or responses to that can swing in some, you know, and obviously Nietzsche and et cetera. And, but yeah, that was just seemed like the very, like, you know, I guess it's sadism, isn't it? But
it's, well, exactly. Yeah. So you can be a panpsychist and a nihilist, really. That's the ultimate. But it seems that another thing Nietzsche said, of course, with regard to suffering is that, you know, in order for us to have evolved to the complex creatures we are, there had to be obstacles down the line, the evolutionary line, right? So there is that, if you value complexity and, you know, high-level sentience consciousness, then there is obviously a positive aspect to suffering. I mean, suffering, there's a reason for suffering in a person's life, which is, you know, it's like a warning light to sort of overcome something, you know, cut your arm. It's okay, like, deal with it. If you didn't feel the pain, you're like, I'll just deal with that next week, right? Or mental suffering often is an interesting question, isn't it? Which is still, is it simply a neurological or pharmacological thing, or is it related to the external world? Obviously, if like, a loved one dies, it is. But to what extent is that the case? So So can mental suffering be a sort of sign that, you know, you're in the wrong world here, you're in the wrong position, you need to change things radically? If it is,
that's socialist, even political, you know.
Right, yeah, so in that respect, then even, you know, you could say that, you know, this is a short-term pain for a long-term gain, a long-term positive thing.
So, but
ultimately, I suppose the point is, against David Pearce, for example, you know, like there is a place for pain and suffering, evolutionarily, but also individually.
And from an artistic perspective.
You know, David Bowie's best work was done when he was like highly depressed.
Although Duncan Trussell has a fantastic thing. He says like the idea that you have to be depressed in order to be good at what you love and your art is. He's like, that almost sounds like words out of straight from the mouth of an imp. Like that is some satanic crap. The idea that you have to
be an
unconnected, happy person in order to do the thing that you love. Like, no, like, of course.
It's not necessary, but there is a correlation.
I think that's the negative extreme of that kind of pain apologism.
Funnily enough, Nick Cave spoke about this recently. He's against music, AI, that because they can't suffer, they can never really express the sort of deep emotions that music is supposed to express.
I think Pearce has an interesting thing that is, you know, if you think about, oh yeah, also cheers. I like doing these things over a cup of tea. English callback. But yeah, if you think about physical pain and anesthetic and operations done without anesthetic, firstly, paradigmatically, the idea of coming up with something like anesthetic would have been a laughable thing for a very long period of time before it actually started to become scientifically possible. Like the majority of advances of science, what is that famous Arthur C. Clarke quote, any significant advancement in technology is indistinguishable from magic. Nonetheless, the point that David makes is that once we reach that point of having anesthetic, the idea of then choosing to have an operation without it seems to hold no justification. And his argument is then to make a corollary with mental pain, emotional pain, and that if we are to imagine some far-off alien species that has overcome the scientific problem of pain, the practical problem of emotional suffering, what reason would there be for them to choose? And you can put it on a map of numbers. Like there's minus 10 experiences, like the Holocaust or the worst thing you could possibly endure, and plus 10. You know, we would say sort of for our children, maybe we would want them to experience a degree of minus 3 or minus 4, but maybe never be able to experience minus 10. It's an interesting way of thinking about it.
I suppose the question is, to what extent is pain causally efficacious, right? Or suffering? Suffering.
That's so, exactly what we're talking about with shame as well. How much?
Yeah, so that's the question, you know. And some people don't believe it is at all, like epiphenomenalists. But if it is, if, you know, like pain and suffering does cause people to change their world, their life, to get rid of that would then be to get rid of like an aspect of determination, which would get rid of our agency to a certain extent. Could you do the same things without pain? You know, that then is like a no-brainer. You know, let's say you're in a terrible, say you're in penury and you think the political situation is horrific, and that penury, that depression or that anguish causes you to become politically active to change things, then you wouldn't want to get rid of that anguish if the anguish was causally efficacious. But if you could just like live in penury and like just be happy about it, right? Would you be motivated to change your situation? It seems like you wouldn't. I mean, just prima facie thinking about it, it seems that you just wouldn't be motivated, right? You wouldn't have the motivation to change. You wouldn't be motivated to change your life situation. You wouldn't be motivated to change your political situation. So like, yeah, imagine a person who's in, you know, like in penury, completely poor, can't afford food hardly or heating, as is the case now, you know, again, with food banks and whatever, heat, you have to choose whether to heat or eat, right? So the anguish that they would feel, the suffering they would feel, seemingly would be a very strong motivator to change, for them to change their position, their status. So they would like try to change their immediate environment, but also try to change the political environment, which has led to this state for them, you know? So I'm just saying that I just wonder, I mean, there's an open question. I don't know, I'm not being dogmatic one way or the other, but it seems to me that the anguish itself would be a strong motivator to get a person to change their life and their world.
And others, for others.
And others,
well.
Yeah, exactly, and others. And also, not, I suppose it makes me think, the pain of others, in the suffering of others, would have a motivating effect on one to help them.
But what is it that they would want to be ultimately changing to then ultimately be freeing them of the pain or of the life situation? Well, because if there's no pain, then perhaps there's nothing to change. Although
someone can't feel lying
in the gutter.
Someone's happy. Well, okay, so
happy driving.
I think if you can't feel pain, then you know you'll get out of that situation, become, you know, millionaire, whatever, and feel the same way anyway, right? So what's the point? I suppose there's levels of qualities of life, you know, duration of life and being able to have a fulfilling, satisfactory life. It's not just a matter of happiness. But, beyond all of this, I don't ultimately think happiness and comfort is the meaning of life. You know, you spoke about the Holocaust. One person who was in the Holocaust was Viktor Frankl. I don't know if you ever read his work, but exactly. So, I mean, like, you know, his whole point is that he could overcome all that suffering because he had a goal, an aim. This one Nietzsche says, well, all you need is a yes. You can overcome any pain and suffering, right? This is more important. This is brings meaning to people's lives. This is more important than happiness. You can go through any unpleasantness if you have a greater cause, usually greater than oneself. This is how psychedelic therapy possibly works as well. You see life, you see the grander scheme of things. So your personal problems become relatively insignificant in comparison to that, so you don't have to mask them with alcohol or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose I imagine it's evolutionary, like to use a particularly strange comparison. For instance, you think of someone like Rupert Sheldrake contrasting with a figure like Richard Dawkins, but also nature and the wider scientific community, and then a figure like Merlin Sheldrake, now father and son, both doing good work, both ethically and intellectually, I would say sharing relatively congruent views amongst a lot of things, not to say they don't differ in different ways, fulfilling similar but very different roles in academia and public social life. So like Rupert was a firebrand of an alternative figure and McKenna and about Abraham as well, you know, almost resistant rebel in the same way your story of the man in poverty, it almost feels like a revolutionary, you know, a political thing. And Merlin still sharing essentially the same message, both sort of philosophically and scientifically, but has been accepted relatively by the scientific community and the wider public community. And one couldn't have happened without the other, simply counterfactually or just chronologically. Perhaps pain and positive experiences are a similar thing, that we've had to evolve through pain, we've had to evolve through suffering, and through that is paving the way, in the same way my working class, immigrant, Jewish, not Holocaust survivors, but pogrom escaping family created better life and better living situation for me. And in the same way, a dolphin is now better than a dolphin was, you know, 100,000 years ago. Maybe there's an evolutionary way of which I think you were speaking of at the start, an evolutionary way of looking at it. But I agree with you. I think meaning, depth, variety of experience trump happiness. And I think the kind of well-being is maybe the better term.
Well-being can mean so many things, right, to different people. So you could say, well-being could be great that you have all these libraries and bookshops around you, you know, living in Oxford or something like that. Whereas to another person, that could be hellish, or vice versa.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I guess well-being as defined as fulfilling a person's own necessary conditions of well-being.
Yeah, and I suppose this is the ultimate question, which is, you know, the old, what's the meaning of life, right? So ultimately,
right, here we go.
You determine whether we should get rid of pain, for example, in this Peircean transhumanist sense or keep it or even emphasize it in a Nietzschean transhumanist sense, for example, requires that one says, listen, here is the ideal. You know, we are progressing to an ideal. You know, now the question is, what is that ideal? Well, that's one question. The preliminary question is there an ideal? Is there some ultimate cosmic telos, aim, goal towards which we are going?
There is a mushroom at the end of the universe.
That's what I believe personally, But so you have to be almost like as a kind of Platonist to believe that, right? So if what's going on there?
Not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I mean, there's things to be said about that. You know, Roger Penrose, Russell Wyatt, they were all Santiago, all Platonists.
Well, I mean, it was you that told me about the Eleusinian mysteries and the ergot. It found in that and how, you know, essentially Platonic realm of forms was an LSD trip.
That was always a speculation. You know, interestingly, I've discovered that there's some more archaeological evidence for that recently since we spoke about it, which is that there was always like, you know, Ruck and Hoffman and Watson, they had this theory that these potion and these Greek mystery religions were possibly ergot, you know, but there was no proof for it archaeologically. Yeah. But they've discovered recently in Spain at this ritual site devoted to Demeter and Persephone, who are the two goddesses of the Eleusinian mysteries as well. They discovered this cup vessel and it had ergot residue in it. So there's chemical sort of evidence that in Spain, 200 BC it was, so concomitant to the Eleusinian mysteries, they were using ergot in a potion, it seems, in devotion to Persephone and Demeter. I mean, there's not absolute proof that they did in Greece as well, but, you know, it's more evidence suggesting that that is the case. But, you know, still, we can't be sure. Maybe new findings will come to light later. But ultimately, yes. Yeah. So, you know, the question is, you know, what's the ultimately, you know, the meaning of life? You know, should we go for, like, comfort, happiness, you know, or should we go for power, development, complexity, beauty? It's very hard to determine one way or the other. If you go for complexity, beauty, and so on, then you don't necessarily go for what is considered morality and comfort.
Well, I think to ask you maybe a particular point question that's very broad and concise in one stroke, hopefully, strokes and discussions of hedonism, which is my bag for sure, but more perhaps, what is the meaning of matter and the congruence of matter mind, you know, more from a metaphysics perspective. And I know this is sort of where you're at right now with your research proposal for philosophy of science for the general reader, as they say, but without cutting any corners, can you speak a little to just metaphysics more generally than just sort of hedonism? Yeah.
Well, I think
that's a big question.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd say ethics generally needs to be based on metaphysics, right? But most people don't look into ethical theory, let alone metaphysics. So, what I mean by that, like we were talking about, you know, like if you believe in progress, then you have to believe in an ideal to which we are progressing, and then you have to then it becomes metaphysical immediately. Well, what is an ideal? You know, is it just culturally bound? Is it individually bound, or is it metacultural? If it's not metacultural, how does one legitimately criticize other cultures and so or historical. So that's just one example of how metaphysics is important for ethical questions, and that relates to what we're talking about with happiness and so on. Generally, though, how metaphysics. So I've got this article coming out in a couple of weeks or so on Frontiers in Psychology, strangely not philosophy, called "On the Need for Metaphysics in Psychedelic Therapy and Research." And the general thrust of that is that psychedelic therapy, psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, as it's called generally now, someone, you know, takes a drug and beforehand they're prepared for it with some, usually two therapists, male, female. Afterwards, they go through an integration phase to integrate their experience into their life to make it significant. It seems that the most effective experiences are what I call metaphysical experiences. You know, they are like almost monistic or atheistic. They relate to Spinoza, Leibniz, people like that, or Kant with noumena, phenomena, distinctions. But of course, psychiatrists, therapists, they don't know anything about metaphysics. And they're just applying what they've learned in psychology generally for therapy, you know, like used to be in analysis, to these new experiences. So it's my contention that there's an additional and optional element of the final integrative phase of psychedelic therapy. There should be recourse to metaphysics, you know, like sort of metaphysics integration. So So like, it has to be intelligible to most people, of course. And you can simplify metaphysics.
And optional.
It should be optional. So some people might not be interested. Some people might not have metaphysical experiences. You know, like some psychedelic experiences are about becoming a better hunter, for example.
That has its role, for sure,
But anyway, for certain people, I think it would be useful. Let's say they've suddenly thought that they've become the universe. Or let's say they've become...
Which in a sense they are. Right.
Well, this has been going to metaphysics immediately, right? So like, discuss that, because, you know, this is, like I said, this therapeutic effect of psychedelics seems to be to create a small self in relation to a grander universe, cosmos.
Right.
That's how it's therapeutic. Beautiful. It seems to be. There's evidence for it, but not for sure. Might be one.
But a connected self.
Yeah, nature, connectedness and connectedness to the universe. And so your own life is relatively insignificant. So don't worry about your little problems. They're really irrelevant.
But also not that you are insignificant and you're out. It's like you are in the fold still.
Yeah, in a way, it's sort of you become like greater than yourself, as it were. So you become, in one way, more significant. But in another way, the way you used to think becomes less significant. Let's put it that way.
But also less relevant, less...
Yeah. So let's say that happens and that has a therapeutic effect. Often this sort of tails away after a few months. And one conjecture as to why that happens is because people have these like metaphysical experiences, but then they think after 2 months when they're back in this ideology that we have in the West, every culture has its own ideology of metaphysics unwittingly on the subconscious level, you know, that must have been a delusion. Couldn't have been true. And they then speak in different ways. Yeah. However, if they're given this option, say, listen, there's this great argument actually for something akin to what you experienced, like from Spinoza, for example, or Leibniz. They might be less inclined to dismiss it. And they might be more inclined to look into it, actually. And this might enrich their lives and keep them at that state.
Absolutely.
That's in clinical practice. But beyond the clinic, I think also it just can lead to life enrichment. You know, it's just
You were speaking to the metaphysical choir here. I mean, one of my earliest memories is my dad saying to me, like, we're sending the ocean and these waves, and we just mentioned the drop in the ocean, that these waves are passing through us, and, you know, in a way of also, I guess, describing wave dynamics as well as the literal situation we were in, and then a metaphysical metaphor/point. He turns to me and he says, every wave that is crashed through your legs right now, like, feel the waves as they pass through, has traveled sort of hundreds of thousands of miles and has changed its particles just for that moment. And then it was for you. And that was all it was.
That's amazing.
It's stuff like that. And I remember being like four and like freaked out and thinking like, wait, is there a limited number of souls? Are souls born in the same way that people are born? And does that mean there are some potential souls that never even get to be souls, let alone people? What is the maximum? And I was
this is why we met on the philosophy course, obviously. Yeah,
it attracts a certain.
The ocean analogy was good. It reminded me a bit of one I was told actually about stars. Basically, the same point that, you know, when you see a star, that light has traveled for maybe billions of years, ending with your vision of it. You know.
Yeah, I got my first tattoo recently. It's a tiny little shell because I interesting. It really strangely connects to the first conversation we were having. And I'm going to decompress and figure out how that connection happened later, because that's interesting. But I was about 13 and I was staying with some Bedouins in the desert, the Negev desert, which is Palestine, and we had this sort of like hot housing guy at our school that was like pushing us to a very, very small group of us. And later found out that he had no qualifications, he had just been let in because he was friends with the headmaster. It was a crazy thing. I got a lot of positives and a lot of negatives out of that. Anyway, we had these like, it started off as a film club. It ended up, we just had conversations. Like just philosophical practice, you know, Socratic dialogues, whatever. We just sat and we just put a timer on and we just start talking, right? Literally what this point in this podcast is. I'm still doing it. I can't stop doing it. And people were doing it long before we did it. And anyway, we'd done this series of them and then we were in the Negev Desert, staying with these Bedouins, who, by the way, make the most fantastic tea. And the trick to it is, talking about happiness and sadness, the trick to it is to put 6 or 7 sugars in. Honestly, so much better, yes. Unarguably better than salt in my tea. Anyway, and we're having this conversation, and then I sort of tangentially look up at the stars, as you say, and you're saying before about insignificance in space, and I begin to have a rather negative experience of insignificance, of, oh my God, I am so tiny and meaningless, and these stars in this galaxy, this universe, are so huge. And then I thought to myself, however, these stars cannot reach out to each other and hug each other. These stars cannot love each other or know each other or talk to each other or hate each other or anything. Whereas I can reach out. Like we said, I can touch you. I can interact with you. I can get to know you. I can connect with someone else, even if that someone is tiny. So I may be small compared to these stars, but I feel they are more insignificant in comparison to me. It wasn't necessarily an arrogant feeling. And I did once meet the head of the Freedom Society at Exeter. Once told me, he said to me, you know, I took LSD, dear chap, and you socialists, you hippie socialists, you know, you go on about all this stuff, but it actually made me feel I was more the center of the universe and more right wing. I was like, oh my God, you've had the experience of coding it wrong. I told this to my first ever girlfriend when I was 15, this experience, and how I had a little shell I was looking at, and I kind of imbued all of this content into this shell. And I told her this over Facebook Messenger, and her response to me was, I love you.
Ah, right.
That was the first thing that we spoke about. And then I lost the shell trying to impress her, so I tattooed it onto my body to recreate it. But I think my entire point that I'm making is just, I feel my life has been full of that kind of metaphysical engagement. I don't know why, a lot of reasons. And I feel my life has been so much better and so much richer.
You are then proof of the point I made, yeah, that metaphysics can really lead to life enrichment, you know? Not just happiness, but there's some kind of motive beyond happiness. I think Russell speaks about this, you know, this kind of need for knowledge, you know, it's not maybe in every person, but I think it's in most. I have to go. I've got
No, so do I. I've massively overrun, but just to put a final pin on it, the concept of valence is the combination of happiness and meaning. So, like seeing your child being born would replace the most pleasurable. It's the highest valence. That's the sort of the new hedonism. It imbues meaning into it. I don't know.
So there's a spanner in the works right at the end. You know, Schopenhauer says there's 3 motives for human action. One is pleasure or happiness. The other one is ego, which needn't be happiness necessarily. Right. The third, though, which is malice. Sometimes even if it doesn't help a person.
I eat meat because it's cruel. Yeah.
But it's not even pleasurable. It's like it's just malice and stuff. I don't know if that's true. Yeah. Maybe it just applied to Schopenhauer himself.
No, I know people like that. I said that person. And interestingly, the thing that I'm overrunning myself on is my personal weekly appointment with a transpersonal psychotherapist. I'll just end by saying your point of ego, etc., transpersonal psychotherapy, the whole concept of it is what you're saying. There is the option to go beyond the personal, whatever that means, whether that's God, whether that's the universe, that should and can be incorporated into therapy.
You reach out and connect to the first part of our conversation. Right. Excellent.
And now I'm going to hang up with you and do a Zoom call, not in real life, with my transpersonal psychotherapist.
Brilliant. Well,
this has been
Alex,
great. This has been
that was good. I think the second half was really good, especially.
Thank you so much. Lovely to catch up with you, and also great. You know, we never spoke at such length and personal depth.
Are you coming to? Yeah, no, it's really, really interesting.
Breaking convention.
So I'll see you there. Three or four philosophy panels there. So.
All right, I'll let you go now. So we overran, but lovely.
No. All good, but I must go, yeah. Okay, really nice to see you again, and I'll see you soon again. See you then. Cheers.
Peace out, Bell Scout.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Hyper Theory. Thanks so much to Peter Hjester-Age for coming on the show. What an interesting conversation. What a fascinating man and his research. If you want to read more about him or his research, his latest paper is linked, and his books and etc. are linked online. Yeah, wow. Little speechless after that conversation. One of those conversations where you really kind of feel, I always feel this way with these conversations, but really felt kind of elated and whole after that. So, yeah. We'll be back soon with another fantastic guest who I can't wait to tell you all who it is. And Hyper Theory is a podcast produced by Starground Productions. It's edited by Robbie Mortimer. The theme song is by Gregor McMurray called Glyph. And I've been your host, Alex Rose. Thank you very much, and stay wavy with those quantum waves. Don't know what that was yet. Yeah.